I'd like to call this meeting to order of the AMX. This is Thursday, March 20th, 2014. It is now 1:33, and I call this to order. We do have a quorum. Item 1B, participation from the, we have none from outside public. We'll go right to item number 2, the minutes of January 30th, 2014.
Move to approve. Motion.
Second. There's a motion, and it's been seconded. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item number 3, staff report, the financial progress report, attachment 3A. Mr. Sagadin.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the first day of spring. I wish we could bring you a little bit better weather, but it's coming. Attachment 3A was the financial progress report in your folders. If you look at line 9 at the bottom of the report, we've expended 60% of the AMAX budget up to this point in the fiscal year. We're about two-thirds of the way through the fiscal year, so we're in very good shape financially, well within budget, and we do recommend your approval at this time, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
So moved.
Motion on the floor. Second?
Second.
Second. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 3B, the technical report. Baker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, Ohio State has a 7-point deficit to overcome, 15 minutes left in the second, so
you're done.
Yeah.
All opposed? All
opposed. NA over.
All right, so technical progress report. The first thing really I want to talk about was MAP 21, our federal highway legislation. As some of you know, we are approaching the transportation fiscal cliff, if you will. Less than 200 days before the bill expires, and at that point we'll probably be on continuing resolutions. In late February, President Obama proposed a $300 billion four-year plan to fund infrastructure with the new highway bill. In this, he had estimated that they would generate about 150 of that $300 billion through tax reform. So that's sort of a new way that we've heard about going about funding this. Right now, it sounds like a gas tax increase is off the table. So we're looking at corporate tax possibly. The $300 billion a year, to give you an example, MAP 21 was a $105 billion bill for 2 years. This proposal would be $300 billion, so we're talking about the difference between $53 billion a year right now would be increased to about $75 billion a year if Obama's proposal was taken up by Congress. However, it seems like the response to it has been pretty lukewarm. There's also been a lot of questions about if tax reform would lead to $150 billion of extra revenue for the trust fund. Again, two of the other things that have been discussed, like the gas tax hike include the VMT taxes, but again, those seem to be at this point DOA. So it'll be interesting to see as we get a little bit closer. I think we had talked about a couple of months ago that there are some members of Congress that would like to see us see the federal government completely divest of highway funding altogether. Well, that also doesn't seem likely. I think it shows that there's a great divide between the fringes of the Congress on how our highways will be funded at a federal level. Another thing, if you may have seen this morning, we sent out an email from Smart Growth America. They released an interesting report regarding highway maintenance and the cost of highway maintenance. They estimated that $45 billion a year was necessary to get all of our roads, the nation's roads, into a state of good repair. They also did a lot of comparisons for states and how much they spent versus expansion projects and maintenance projects, and found that nationwide, between 2009 and 2011, we had spent $20 billion on expansion and $16 billion on maintenance. And they have raised the concern that, while overall nationally, VMT for vehicle miles traveled has been steady, it hasn't increased, Our congestion hasn't increased, but yet we're still spending more to widen roads than to maintain the system. And obviously that's a nationwide look. I think when you look locally, there are still areas of congestion that need to be replaced or that need to be fixed. But it's a very interesting report, and we provided the link. And I don't know, Jason, if you want to add anything to that or some of the other stats.
I think just one local context point was, as a lot of you know, back in 2007, we created the AMATS resurfacing program. Prior to that, we actually didn't pay for road maintenance or resurfacing unless it was done as part of another type of project. So I think that was an example, going back to then when we were looking at trends in the area, realizing we're kind of a low to no growth region as a whole, and we saw a lot of the needs at the local level, especially more recently, you know, with the recession then and income taxes and other taxes being down, et cetera. And I wanted to thank actually Jim Bowling from Kent, looked at some numbers on our resurfacing program. And when we look at the average pavement condition rating back in 07, it was a 64 out of 100. The most recent round of applications, it was a 59. So we have seen there's been a little bit of a downward trend. And the fact roads are getting worse pavement-wise isn't good, but what does make us feel good is roads that really need to be resurfaced are being applied for and funded. And another thing that Jim had found is the first year we did the program, we had 6 different communities apply for resurfacing. Last time we had 18. And similarly, we had, that was 6 communities versus 18. And then the number of projects, the first time we had 16 separate projects applied for, and last time we had 68. So the programs continue to get more popular. I think our federal funds have helped to kind of fill in a gap in the system where maintenance needs to be done. We're glad to continue doing that. And I think as you move forward, we're always looking for feedback from local governments. Is the way our program is structured, is it working for you? Is it meeting your needs? But we feel pretty good, you know, given what Curtis talked about in that report, that our funding is being put towards some of the greatest needs in the region.
And finally, I think the last thing I'd like to add is that, that we're working on, we've got this last round of applications, we've got our first applications looking at the Safe Routes to Schools projects, infrastructure projects. The state obviously has a small pot of money for Safe Routes, but really that doesn't cover the amount of needs that are being developed through school travel plans and the program. One of the things we would like to do is set up a little group committee ad hoc to look at some ways that AMATS should be handling the Safe Routes to Schools programs. We've had some interested communities that have that have done the school travel plan process, and now they're looking at trying to figure out ways to fund it other than just the ODOT process. But also, we still have school districts that aren't aware of the Safe Routes program, and that's something that we're trying to figure out is what's the best way for us as an agency to reach out to school districts as well as through the local communities to actually develop maybe a little bit stronger of a system, or is it something that, you know, we believe that AMATS shouldn't really be involved in and let the state, I mean, in terms of the infrastructure, let the state fund it. So if anyone's interested in participating or providing some feedback, you can see me afterwards. We do have some people from the TAC that have expressed interest, and it would be great to have a few members of the policy committee as well. So with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
There are no questions. We'll go on to item 3C, the AMATS Federal Fund Report. Jason? Or Victor. Victor. Sorry.
The ending balance for this fiscal year, 2014, will exceed the amount that we're allowed to carry over in FY15. You mentioned this at the meeting back in January. What we did since that time, we talked to a couple of MPOs in Ohio, the MPO out of Columbus and Cincinnati, and we've been able to trade $5.5 million in the fund this year, and that will be returned to us over the next 2 years. We're slightly still over the amount that we're allowed to leave unspent this year. I've asked ODOT to give me the exact number on what that is. And once that number comes in, what we'll do is submit a waiver request to ODOT for that remaining portion so that that those funds don't lapse. And we're just simply say that we're saving up for future year projects, and that should be an acceptable waiver request. The new statewide cement funding program, the statewide committee is meeting at the end of this month to take a look at the application that will go out for this funding program. Hope to have that done, wrapped up either at that meeting or sometime in early April. So then at the earliest, probably by mid to late April, we'll start the process here, possibly May. We'll start that CMAQ funding program application. It'll look a lot like just any of our other funding programs. In this round of funding, though, for this CMAQ, we're not going to do a letter of intent statement. We simply just submit the applications, those will be filled out and returned to us. Then the TAC TIP subcommittee will take a look at them, score them, rank them, and then bring a list of recommended projects to fund both the TAC and the policy. And so that'll be sometime in the summer. And then once the policy, this committee approves the final list, that'll go down to Columbus, either in August or September. And then that statewide, that'll go in the hopper with all the rest of the projects from the state. And then by the end of this calendar year, we would know which projects are being funded from the new statewide CMAQ funding program. The recently approved projects for funding were approved back in January. By now, hopefully, everybody's submitted their programming packages into ODOT for those projects. ODOT will be getting project identification numbers assigned to those projects, and then starting sometime in the spring, and then also through the summertime, we'll have scope meetings on those projects. And the last thing I want to mention, the PCR subcommittee did meet last week, again, talking about the details of what contract language will be between, as you recall, Suffolk County has agreed to be the fiscal agent for this whole process between the county and each of the individual communities. So hopefully what will happen over the summertime then is the county will sit down with all the individual communities and work out some of the details and have all that process done by the end of summer, so that in the fall time they can start working on hiring a consultant to do those PCRs, and they'll start probably about a little more than a year from now. And then once those will all be gotten next summer, and they'll be all done by the end of next summer, which will be right time for our next round. So that's all I have on this item. If anybody has any questions, we have to answer.
Yes, sir.
Vic, this is, I don't get to attend as many public officials meetings as some of the other members here, but this is the first time I've run across a financial officer telling us that we've got excess funds that we have to deal with. Is this just an accounting issue, a bookkeeping issue, or is there some substantive significance as to why the funds are here and not there, or why they are at risk?
Well, ODOT came up with a policy last year so that the Ohio MPOs were, let's back up for a second, Ohio MPOs were carrying over, I think collectively, almost $100 million each and every year, unspent funds. So they had projects, they were always in the future, and either they were delayed or for one reason or another, but in the end, we kept carrying over large amounts of fund each and every year. So we put a policy in place saying that we're only allowed to carry over 25% of our actual annual allocation for all the MPOs. So we're at that point now. If you look on the table, on that second page, if you look at the bottom of fiscal year 2014, you'll see now that the balance is $7 million. So if we add five to that, we just take five off and get two other MPOs in Ohio. So we're slightly over the amount, which again, I don't know exactly what it is at this point, of what they allow us to carry over. And to make matters even more complicated, it is by individual funding source. So even though this is a cumulative number, our at-risk funding source was CMAQ. And to make that even more complicated is next year we're on that statewide CMAQ program. But this year we're not. We're still under the old policy for that funding program. We exceeded the threshold we don't have a lot. So we have to trade off the funds or ask for a waiver. And you know, we don't always have every single year, we don't have neatly this much money and this many projects to match it. that some of the larger projects take longer or are delayed, and so projects don't always match up with the money even every single year. So this is a case where we have funding in 16, we're going to overspend, but we don't have enough projects in 14 and 15 for those funds.
And so the point of my question, one of the points might have been, the funds that are excess, that are sitting in the account, are they funds that have already been allocated to projects and just not yet been disbursed, or are they something else?
They've been programmed for future year projects, but not in the current year. So this policy ties us to the annual. So what we're kind of doing is saving up money for the future. But in this year, we don't look at it because we don't have projects in that.
So we are saving up money to fund projects in the future, but we have to save it in somebody else's account.
Well,
maybe to clarify a little bit, the funds are they're all allocated. And just a little bit more context, traditionally, and this is still the case, MPOs are under what's called fiscal constraint. So traditionally, we haven't been able, if we have $5 million, we can't spend more than $5 million, even if it's in the future, because each year it has to be in fiscal balance. So what would happen over time is, and this was a good problem to have in a way, projects would come in under budget, which is good, except all of a sudden you thought it was a $5 million project, it was $3.5 million, so we have a balance of $1.5 million. Another thing that will happen is projects get delayed. You know, the project's getting ready to be constructed, they find out there's a buried fiber optic cable that nobody knew about, it was going to be in fiscal year 2012, now it's going to be in fiscal year 2013, so even if that project was in June at the end of the fiscal year and it sold in July, on the books, it didn't sell when it was supposed to, so we have a carryover. So those kinds of issues, at least speaking for our own MPO, we've always spent every dollar we have. They've always all been allocated. But in a year-to-year basis, if you have a $5 million project and it slips, all of a sudden on paper you have a $5 million unexpended balance. So that's kind of the root of how these projects, you could be confident that we're spending the money we get, which I guess is the bottom line.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, we'll move on to item 3D, NEO report. Jason?
Okay, thanks. Out on the table, and if you didn't grab one on the way in, I encourage you to pick one up. There's a guidebook put together by the Northeast Ohio Sustainable Communities Consortium that outlines the vision that organization adopted. And as you know from, I think, reports I've given over the last couple years, AMATS has been a part of that organization. The NEOSCC board met at the end of February and did approve this document. Just to give you a quick sense, without belaboring it too much, of what's in here, this is a couple years' worth of effort. This was a HUD-funded project. It's basically predicated on looking at the future of transportation, land use, public utilities, economic development and environmental protection in a 12-county area between now and 2040. Some of the takeaways, I think, if you look through the document that you'll find is the vision that's outlined here, it's very supportive of what we were talking about earlier, preserving the funding that we already have to maintain the existing infrastructure. One of the big issues dealt with in this report overall is the fact that, unlike a lot of metropolitan areas in the United States, Northeast Ohio has actually lost about 7% of its population since 1970, but we've expanded our developed footprint with all the infrastructure that entails by around 25% over that same time. So what this is kind of looking at big picture is the realization that, you know, there's kind of two twin fiscal issues looming or already here for the region. One is in the inner cities, in a lot of cases, there's a huge problem with abandoned properties. For example, in Cleveland, there's 15,000 vacant houses right now. There's about 2,300 in Akron. That's costly to try to mitigate. At the same time, as more and more land is developed, local governments in outlying areas are under pressure to expand infrastructure and so forth. That's kind of an old story, but one of the takeaways is that we'll have to come up with some sort of strategy for at least maximizing the funds that are spent to do those twin challenges, mitigating the abandonment and vacancy, and also building new infrastructure. So that's kind of the gist of what's in there for the future of the organization right now. The HUD grant is just about expired. Almost all the funding that went into it is expended at this point. The board of NEOSCC is continuing to talk. We're also a nonprofit organization. There's some aspiration of continuing that. And basically the pillars behind that nonprofit would be three A's. There would be advocate, assemble, and assist. And right now the board is kind of working through assist on what, assemble to do what, advocate for what. Generally it's what's included in this document, but I think the aspiration of it is how can we work together as a region to really be fiscally conservative and maximize public investment where we can. So I encourage you to take a look at it. There's a lot of information on the website, vibrantneo.org. We'll continue to report out, I think, on what the organization's activities are as that evolves. And if you have any questions, I would be glad to talk to you anytime or put you in touch with the NEOSCC staff.
Thank you. Item number four, the old business. Anyone have any old business to bring up? Item number five, new business. Today we have a presentation from Andrea Stevenson from ODOT. And she's walking to the podium.
Learn about. I will try to take notes, and if I don't know the answer, I'll certainly get you in touch with somebody who can answer those questions for you. So it is a real pleasure to be here today. I appreciate being invited and look forward to getting to meet more of you as we grow in our local program at ODOT. One of the things that's always of particular interest to locals as we go out and meet with them is, locals are having a hard time coming up with the funds for transportation improvements. There's a lot of interest out there. There's a lot of need out there from even roadways, bridges, pavements, bike paths, trying to do enhancement type opportunities within the communities. So we try to educate people on what those opportunities are. And then we also have a local training assistance program that I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today. So we want to try to make you familiar with those programs. I know that District 4 works very closely with AMETS and all of you, and they have a very aggressive program and they do a very good job. And so typically they're your first point of contact when you are working with ODOT. But if there is something that you need from central office, we're certainly there to support District 4, to support AMETS, and to support all of you locally. Just to kind of put a local mission into one slide here from a statewide perspective. It just must be the angle behind that. So, on the local system here across the state, we have 937 cities and municipalities and villages. We have about 1,100 law enforcement agencies, 88 counties, 28,000 bridges, which we're only second in the nation to Texas. And so there's a lot of need out there for structures and structure replacement and reconstruction. 70,500 miles of roads, 3,000 miles of bike paths, 159 public use airports, 12 highest transit ridership in the U.S. And this is just the local system. This is not counting the interstate, state routes. This is your system, the local system, that you're responsible for maintaining and upgrading on a regular basis. So you have a pretty big load you're carrying statewide, And we understand that there's a real need out there. You know, recently we've been working on our Ohio Bridge Partnership Program, and those were bridges that were to help fund, those were funds that were to help replace bridges across the state for the counties and the municipalities, and there were approximately 900 bridges on that list, and we were only able to fund 200. So there is a tremendous need out there, and hopefully we're going to share some information with you that can help you out. So our objective in our office, we have three main functions, working with communities to help provide funding sources for infrastructure. We have a number of the programs that are listed in this booklet that I passed out today. This is a relatively new booklet. District 4 staff may have shared this with you. I did bring a few extras if you have some mayors or transportation superintendents that would like to have these. But we manage several of these programs. We work very closely to train local transportation staff. So we have a program at our office called the Local Training Assistance Program. And it used to be housed at Ohio State University, and it was transferred to ODOT probably about 13 years ago. And so our number one emphasis and focus is to provide training to locals, whether it be administrators or, you know, highway workers who are out there repaving roads and filling potholes and doing actual roadway work. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it's a great resource. A lot of the courses are free. We actually come to you. You don't have to come to Columbus for the training necessarily. So lots of great opportunities there. Additionally, there's a tremendous amount of resources out there when it comes to NPOs, the ODOT district offices, transportation stakeholders, ODOT, and then there's just a lot of resource material out there. I mean, if you're looking at the website, you see ASHTO and TRV and everything that's out there. Tremendous amount of resources to help locals really make sure that they're on track with where they need to be in regards to legislative changes that happen at a national or state level. There we go. So the title of the presentation today is really how to apply for funding. And I recently spoke at the Auditor of State's Local Community Day, and hopefully none of you were in that session because it's a very similar presentation. But what I like to do is kind of give you a summary of some of the programs that may be of interest to you that you may not be aware of, some tips for applying, some things that we look for, items that are important to us when we're actually scoring these projects, and how we work with the districts to actually select those projects, get them funded, and advance them to construction. These are a few of the programs that I'm going to talk about here today. Like I said, a lot of them are in this book. We actually have another one on our website that is an expanded version of this. This is more of the pocket guide to programs at the department. So first of all, we'll talk about these programs, and then I'll break down a couple programs for you to kind of describe what our expectations are when you're applying for projects. So we have our small city program, and that is something that's administered from our office. It is for small cities outside of metropolitan planning organizations. It is for populations from 5,000 to essentially 25,000. And really, it's for any kind of project that's really out there. It could be a bridge replacement, a widening job. It could be intersection improvements. And it's based on what that need is out there. And so on an annual basis in January, we announce that we are looking for applicants and that we are looking for projects to fund. We have $8 million a year, and currently we are funding out like to 16 and 17. So like they talked about earlier with the funding issue, we are planning those projects out 3 or 4 or 5 years so that those projects can go to the project development phase. You can actually, as locals, ensure that you have that 20% match and really be ready to deliver that project in the next 3 to 4 years. So we are in the process now of evaluating our applications that we received. For the $8 million that we have for the years that we're programming right now, we actually received about $32 million worth of applications. And so we will be sitting down and looking at them from a competitive perspective to see which projects have the greatest need, which projects support the objective of our small cities program. We have another program called Local Major Bridge. This is a $25 million funding program where we look at bridges that are on the local system that are larger in nature. A lot of times the smaller bridges get funded and replaced, and this program provides an opportunity to those that have a large deck area. We look for those projects that have high EDT, require high capacity. We, a few years ago, the department actually had a list of these bridges, and so we can sort those out and understand which bridges are actually eligible and, you know, determine what their general appraisal ratings are and sufficiency ratings are for those bridges. Right now, we have actually repaired and replaced and reconstructed a lot of those bridges, and on an annual basis, we're looking at those projects on a case-by-case basis, trying to determine which ones we're going to fund. So currently, we have a project in Dayton, Ohio that is in the project development phase, and we're looking forward to go to construction in 2019. So kind of like what we talked about earlier with that carry forward, we're carrying some of the money forward from this program into those future years to help fund some of these local major bridge projects so that we can get those replaced and they can provide effective transportation capacity for the motorists in that area. We have a municipal bridge program, and this is actually a program that's eligible to anybody statewide. It's also $8 million. Provides federal funds for municipalities for bridge replacement or rehab. Again, we're on a January solicitation cycle, so we are also reviewing those applications right now. Similar situation as our small cities program, where we received probably about $25 million worth of requests, and we've got $8 million to expend. So we spend a lot of time sitting down with our district offices, really looking at what the needs are and ranking those projects based on the need that's out there and the criteria that we've established. With each of these programs, it's 80% federal funds, 20% local match, and I understand that that 20% local match isn't always easy to come up with, but these are great opportunities, and if you have specific needs and you can isolate it to one of these programs, please call me, please call somebody in our office and visit us about it or talk to your district office, and you know you can begin working on your application for next January and really collect that data and have a better understanding and a great application when you're submitting it to us. When we are looking at these programs, we truly are looking at who has the greatest need, who's going to have the greatest benefit. Now, but something that we always like to see, if you can leverage more dollars from Ohio Public Works, Clean Ohio funds, whatever the case may be, if you can package up something that has multiple funding sources and you submit that to us, that allows for more projects to be built across the state, and that's something that we take into consideration when we are in the process of selecting projects. A few other funds that might be of interest to you, we provide $2.25 million a year to metro parks across the state, and this is actually through the Ohio Parks and Recreation Association. So if you work closely with them and you have a need in your community, that's may include like a parking lot in a metro park, it could be an access point from a transportation area connecting up a park or green space to an access area. This is a great opportunity to seek some of those kind of funds. They actually manage the program for us, and so if you contact the Ohio Parks and Recreation Association and make them aware of the fact that you're interested in some of these funds, begin working with them and do the same thing, put a nice package together and submit something to them for their consideration. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit about our County Bridge Safety Program and our SCP programs. We actually have entered into an agreement with the County Engineers Association of Ohio. We work very closely with them. On an annual basis, we give them about $60 million to administer projects through the County Engineers. So they are looking at and evaluating bridges that need to be replaced on a county level, safety projects, or standard STP projects, which STP dollars essentially you have a lot of flexibility with those funds to replace bridges or roadways, do intersection improvements, those sorts of things. And so the CEAO goes out and meets locally with the counties every year. Typically, they meet with our district offices as well. And so if you work closely with your county engineers, this is an opportunity to really find resources to replace those bridges and safety hotspots that may be in your communities. The last one is our Transportation Alternatives Program. We get $11 million a year. This is for more of a rural statewide program. Each of the large MPOs gets a sub-allocation from FHWA for the Transportation Alternatives Program, and AMETS, I'm sure you, I don't know what your TAP fund is. How much do you typically get?
1,000.
So from a, an MPO perspective here, you get 900,000, and a lot of the MPOs get approximately that much. It's based on the size of the Metropolitan Planning Organization and the population within those communities. So we have a lot of flexibility here to fund transportation alternative projects. We're going to break this particular funding source down a little bit, and I'll give you some ideas for how you might be able to apply for those funds. But it's for things like bicycle and pedestrian facilities, enhancing your communities, historical enhancements, environmental mitigation. So it covers a wide comprehensive list of projects that you might be interested in. From ODOT's perspective, what we do each year, we're also going through the application process right now. Again, we had $11 million. We got about $32 million worth of applications. We're sorting through those now and asking them to provide more detailed information to us. We will review those. We have a statewide committee that sits down with us and reviews all the applications, and then in August we announce what those projects are actually going to be. Again, it's an 80-20 flexible fund where you get 80% federal dollars, 20% local match. So we've talked a little bit about this. For our program, it's going to be applicants not located within the town. I know that most of you are. And so what you would want to do is work very closely with AMETS, talk to them about what your needs are as transportation alternatives for your communities, and begin working with them. And I'm sure they already do that on a regular basis with you when they're looking at projects in your program. This is really just a map of what we fund. Anything that you see in white is what we fund at ODOT. Anything in color is what an MPO has responsibility for and actually funds there. MPOs in Lima, in Newark, in Wheeling, in Belmont County, and Parkersburg actually have opted out. There are smaller MPOs, and they have opted out of their TAP program and participate in our rural program. And so typically what occurs with them is they're such small MPOs, they may only get $100,000 or $75,000, which doesn't go very far with the transportation project. And so they have an opportunity to be more competitive in our statewide program and receive more money going through the rural program at ODOT. So this is just some TAP eligibility criteria. Must be a public agency, must demonstrate public benefit, accessible to the general public, and publicly owned. So many of you already know the types of projects we're talking about here, but very specific criteria when it comes to what FHWA requires to be eligible for these funds. Historic projects must be listed or determined eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. What we require with our program is for the local to demonstrate that they have the cash on hand to match the 20%. We don't want to get in a situation where you're ready to go to construction, we've given you the 80%, and the 20% is missing, and the project gets delayed or can't be constructed because of no cash flow. We also look at projects where the criteria, where there's no maintenance issues with past performance, concerning liability, negligence, or safety, and we require that you must meet criteria for at least one of the three funding sources. So these are some of the types of projects that you can use TAP funds on: bike and ped, rails to trails, safe routes for non-drivers, which is really a safe routes to school program. They have two categories there where they have more of an educational type of program where they are educating schools and students about safety in regards to getting from their home communities to their schools. And then we have the infrastructure side as well. And we have a very aggressive program and work very closely with communities and schools. I do agree with what you were saying earlier. There are a lot of schools out there that aren't aware that these funds are actually eligible. And so it's good if you can take that information back to your school boards and your superintendents to make aware of these programs, because they really are needed, and it's a great benefit to the community. We also looked at scenic and historic highways, other types of community improvements, which aren't used very often, like invasive species control, those sorts of things, and then environmental mitigation. Environmental mitigation is not something that we typically get a lot of applications for, but that's in the case of, you know, you may have to do something to mitigate an impact that was created on a larger project or something that may be happening in a community. So like I mentioned earlier, we have our solicitation process. It starts in January, we end in August. Well, how is your solicitation process normally?
We usually start in the fall.
Okay. So they're kind of more on the last quarter of the calendar year, looking at TAP projects here at AMX. Be sure to get in contact with them if you have questions and have a need to get some of these funds. Safe Routes to School. This is a program that Julie Walkoff at ODOT manages. Like I said earlier, we're looking at solid engineering, good education, encouragement, enforcement, evaluating what the needs are out there. This has been a great program on a statewide basis with the MPO support. We have $4 million in our annual allocation, and we get federal funding with MAP 21 up to 80%. We also, at ODOT, we augment that funding, so we use full revenue credit for the 20% match. So it's a great deal because projects typically get funded at 100% without any local participation required. So we talked about eligible entities, a local public agency, they have to have a school travel plan, and that's really understanding, you know, where are the kids located, where are those populations, how do they get to school, the shortest, safest distance you can possibly get them there. They're all, and here it's talking about the MPO areas as well. So any questions on those so far? I'm sure you're all very well informed on some of these issues. Okay. County Bridge Program. We talked a little bit about this specifically for county engineers, a $35 million annual allocation solicited every August. We have about 16,000 plus bridges on the county maintenance program, and funding is available for on or off system bridges. 80% participation for construction only. So very aggressive program, a great opportunity for county engineers. And I'm assuming there are no county engineers here, but most of the municipalities, villages. Oh, you're a county engineer? Okay, have you taken advantage of this program? Great. Let me hear, what county are you from? Okay, good, thanks. Yeah.
The last slide meant stuff about opportunities for 100% funding.
Mm-hmm.
What were those?
So with the Safe Routes to School program, you get 80% federal match, and then what ODOT does is instead of the local paying the 20%, we use toll revenue credit money to augment that for you. So really, ODOT is putting up the 20% on behalf of the local.
Thank
you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There we go. So we talked about this one. So for the County Bridge Program, there's some standard criteria that we use that typically is used to evaluate bridges and understand what those needs are out there. Structural deficiency, functional capacity, general appraisal, efficiency rating. There's a list here if you can read that. So very stringent criteria to determine who actually gets funding for these particular bridges. Pretty large program. And you know, one of the things that we have implemented this year, it's separate from this, is our hybrid partnership program. So the department put an extra $110 million towards county and municipal bridges. And between this program, the Ohio Bridge Partnership Program, it's a great benefit to some of the communities to really get out there and get some of these bridges fixed that would not ordinarily be repaired for several years. We have our county safety program, $12 million annually. Again, we go out and do that every August with the CEAO. These are actually projects that are needed because of high accident rates. There's safety issues out there, intersections that may not be functioning as they should be, bridge locations, or other areas that may have severe safety issues. Funding is available for any roadway classification, and it is an 80% participation rate for locals covering 20 for construction only. We focus a lot on construction because we want to see the locals have a vested interest in a lot of these projects, and so we will require that the PE engineering, environmental, and right-of-way be covered by the locals and provide that funding for the construction to see the project through. Our county safety program, again, applications solicited in August, and these are typically some of the things that we're looking at when it comes to understanding what the needs are out there and ranking those projects in order of priority and importance. Eligible projects, it can be a wide variety of things, striping of pavement, signs, intersection improvements, shoulder widening, pedestrian bike improvements, a long, long list. Typically, we cap our pavement markings at $150,000 and our guardrail projects are capped at $300,000. Our STP program, this is one of our most flexible funds that we have available to the county engineers, $12 million annually. Again, a lot of the same similar functions when it comes to selecting those projects and working with the county engineers. We provide funding for studies, safety improvements, reconstruction, bridges, roadways. This is really where we have a lot of flexibility. To be eligible, it has to be on the federal aid roadway with the exception of bridges. Again, it's an 80% funding opportunity with 20% carried by the locals. Projects are selected according to priority rank, and funding is received through these programs and then divided by county roadway mileage. One of our last programs I'm going to focus on today is our safety program. This is probably one of the most aggressive programs we have in the department. I've really been trying to improve the safety numbers, and actually ODOT won a national award this year for the safety program. And really, it's aggressiveness of getting out there and trying to reduce crashes and accidents and fatalities. So we spend about $72 million a year funding transportation projects. Michelle May, our central office, is the program manager for this program. We're looking at severe crash locations on any public road. So we're not discriminating one way or the other, whether it's an ODOT road, a local road. Anybody's eligible for this money. Again, administered by Michelle May. She has an application cycle that where applications are due on April 30th and September 30th. And then funding is available for PE right-of-way and construction. So this is an opportunity to really fund the project from cradle to grave as it develops and moves towards construction. Requests typically range from $50,000 to $5 million, and there is a $5 million max on the funding grant that you can get for one of these projects. So why any public road? Why are we interested in seeing the numbers drop? When you look at the ODOT system versus the local system by far has more fatalities, more serious injuries, and more total crashes. And so it's our objective to see those numbers drop statewide, system-wide, and we're willing to provide those funds and work cooperatively with the locals to ensure that those numbers are dropping in, our communities are safe. This is just an eligibility criteria. Anybody can have a crash location, but what we're looking for, and some of this criteria at times is on a case-by-case basis, any public roadway, at least 10 crashes, and a rate of one million vehicle miles traveled over 3 years. Local projects with a lower threshold are evaluated on a case-by-case basis, and then a local match is required unless some signs, signals, or pavement markings. These are the types of projects. Again, it's pretty broad. The area of emphasis and focus is to reduce an area that has a safety issue or a hazardous traveling issue out there for our transportation system. One other short program, a lot of people are not aware of this program, so we've been trying to get the word out. We have a township sign program, and we develop a list of townships across the state that have issues out there with safety, with high accidents, and we actually notify them and make them aware of the opportunity to fund signs for their township at 100%. And so Victoria Beal in our office is responsible for this program. It's been pretty popular. People are starting to hear about it and take advantage of it now. We look at the eligible townships and ask them to apply. Once approved, they can obtain signs through ODOT's cooperative purchasing agreement. We essentially handle everything for the townships. We identify who they are. We go to them and say, please apply. We'd like to give you free money. Then we give them free money, and then we order the signs for them based on what they need and what needs to happen out there. And we fund it, we do all the purchasing, the signs show up, and all you really have to do is put them in the ground and ensure they stay there. So it's a great opportunity for townships. We really like this program a lot. Not a lot of funding, it's $1 million, but it's enough to kind of get out there and focus on the townships that have a need. This is kind of our priority ranking system. We picked the top 50 townships across the state. These are some of the signs that are eligible for the funding. So you can see here there's a wide variety of signs that can handle a variety of safety issues that are out there. We have intersection eligible signs. And then we follow the manual uniform traffic control devices when implementing this program and working with the townships. So we ask that they be aware of that and install the signs according to the guidelines that have been established. Any questions on the funding program? I know a lot of this may be some repeat material, but wanted to give you some thoughts from ODOT as to how this process works and really begin making that connection with you and District 4 to help you out if you have that desire to apply for some projects. Okay, I'm going to go through our LTAP program real briefly, and then I'll share a few thoughts with you that are not on the slide presentation as to where we're headed and what we're going to do in 2014 and 2015 with our local programs and some of the new things that we're going to be working on. So our LTAP program, like I said, it's housed at ODOT. It was at Ohio State University. 100% of the emphasis is to train locals. We have a listserv site. We encourage all of you to get on that. Free training in most cases. In some cases, you may have to pay for some training, but it's pretty minimal most of the time. So we have technical training sessions. We have a route and navigation program, which we'll talk about. Rural road safety audits. We have a publications database transportation library that you can borrow from. And we have a circuit rider program, which is a program where we come out and train your locals. So this is an example of a vegetation management class that we had in 2012. As you can see, it's packed. We get a wide variety of people. We get ODOT employees, locals, counties, municipalities, villages. They are very well attended. We have 156 different training opportunities typically per year, and last year we trained, if I remember correctly, about 6,000 people throughout the year, and not to be bragging about it, but we have one of the highest regarded LTAP centers in the country as it pertains to DOTs and transportation, so we're very proud of the work they do, and they're very aggressive in getting out and training your staff and your locals. Some of the topics that we train on: pavement condition ratings, culvert inventory, erosion sediment control, show me the money. Maybe some of you attended this. This is something we have in Columbus, and it is an all-day session where we talk about funding sources. So we invite Ohio Public Works and the State Infrastructure Bank, and we talk about a lot of the stuff I'm sharing with you today. And so we try to get all of the people that have money to provide to locals to come to one place, invite all of you, and make you aware of those funding opportunities. stormwater management, work zone, traffic control, a whole host of subjects that are available to folks out there. Our transportation library, we will actually mail the information to you. We have DVDs, VCRs, tapes, books, whatever you need. It's available, and we will track that down for you if we can't find it and find a resource for you to obtain that information. So we work with other libraries and state agencies. Our circuit rider program, this is really going out to the locals. We have snow and ice circuit rider. Road safety for everyone. Workplace safety. So there's a wide variety of classes that will actually come out as teacher staff. That is really what I wanted to present to you today. A couple other things I wanted to share. Within our program, we have the funding opportunities available to the locals. We have the LTAP program. But one of our biggest roles is really to work with the locals in the local administered contract program. And so you have an opportunity as a local to manage your own construction contracts that have federal dollars on them. And we administer that program. And so we typically have about 200 projects per year, $330 million. District 4 has one of the most aggressive local programs in the state and manage it very well. So there's a chance that most of you or a large percent of you are participating in that program already. But we work with all the districts in developing the policy, working with FHWA, our construction office, to ensure that when you're a local that you're trained, you know how to administer those construction projects when they have federal dollars attached to them, and that you know we're advancing the program forward. One of the things we're going to do this year is we're going to have more of an opportunity to work with locals in getting some more of the information out in regards to federal aid projects. And so we have developed some e-learning tools, and essentially what you'll do is get online, and we have a series of training modules that you'll be able to work through, and we've worked with an advisory group to get some of those set up. And so in July, we're going to be rolling that out to the locals, asking them to participate in this if they're going to be involved in our LPA contract administration program, and really begin saturating themselves with some of these issues so that they can be more well-versed in our LPA processes. On a national level, our LPA program is one of the highest risk programs that FHWA has identified. So we're always working, trying to work very closely with LPAs to make sure that we have provided the latest and greatest information. So that's going to be something that's going to be coming out. And by January of 2015, really asking a lot of the LPAs that administer projects to have taken that training and worked with us on those tools. We're also going to be setting up an LPA day. We've just been awarded some funds to come out to each of the regions of the state and have a full-day session inviting some other folks to participate with us in making all of you aware of funding and other opportunities that are available through FHWA, Ohio Public Works. And so we'll be setting those up this fall and coming out to each of the regions to have LPA days, working very closely with our districts as well. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity today to visit with you about these programs, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those for you.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming up from Columbus for this. A lot of information in the Green Book that you also brought up is a great resource. I know our local staff does an excellent job working with all the communities to about all these programs, and I thank that staff for doing that. And does anybody else have any questions for her at this time? Yes.
You mentioned townships. Are you making spatial for very small communities or small villages?
Small villages fall into these categories like the small city program, municipal grid program, and so they would be eligible for these funds as well.
No, but I'm saying very small villages.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, and I don't know if you're specifically talking about signs or
I'm talking about anything that applies to very small communities.
You know, the small city has the threshold of 5,000.
Very small village.
But the municipal bridge program, you would be eligible for that. TAP, where we talked about that, you would also be eligible for that. Okay. So, what city are you from?
I'm not
or village?
From the city. I'm from Brayley Village.
Okay.
And we are tiny.
Okay. How tall are you? How small are you?
493.
Okay.
Yeah.
We
can. How many
do you
there?
1,300.
Yeah. 3,600. Sorry, Dave.
Thank you.
I can leave my business card with you, and if you're interested in something specific, we can kind of help guide you in the direction that where you may be able to Okay. Any others?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Item 5B, the draft 2010-2012 pedestrian report. Mr. Folia.
Chairman, back in December, I presented a bicycle safety report to you, and at that time we promised that we would do the same thing with pedestrians, and that is what I'm going to talk about today. The purpose of this report, a pedestrian has been defined as any person traveling on foot, but it also includes anybody in the street right-of-way, including those on rollerblades, skateboards, scooters, and wheelchairs. This was particularly interesting to me because I think all of us are pedestrians almost on a daily basis, sometimes several times a day. So this not only applies to those in our community, but it also applies to us. The purpose of this report was to try to figure out why and where these crashes are occurring, and it will be another tool that we'll use when we fund these type of improvements. Pedestrian crashes have a few unique characteristics. First of all, they have a real high percentage of injuries. 86% of pedestrian crashes result in an injury. They're usually more random. We don't have the 35% at one, or the 35 crashes at one intersection like we do with vehicular. They're usually related to population density, which only is logical because more people, more cars, more conflicts, and usually a corridor or a systematic approach to solving these are more effective. Here's a map of the pedestrian crashes. This is the one that was in your handout. I just wanted to very quickly highlight one thing on this map. The red dots are pedestrians in the age range of 18 to 23. I call those young adults. They're also college students. And it's a little hard to see on the screen, but there's a concentration of red dots in Kent, and there's a concentration of red dots around the University of Akron. I can't say for sure those are college students, but they are college student age range. They tend to go up and down over the years, the number of crashes. I took in another 3 years to try to develop a trend line, and as you can see, over the years, there has been a slight increase. This report covers 2010, 2011, and 2012. In those 3 years, there were 459 pedestrian-related crashes. When I started this project, the first thing we did was we downloaded the information from the Ohio Department of Public Safety, the crash files, And then we went to the and obtained the police reports, which can be done online now. We looked at each police report sometimes two and three times, and then we kind of developed different groups of and types of crashes. Pertaining to fault, the vehicle driver was faulted in most cases. 216 or 47% of the incidents, the driver was faulted. The most predominant citation was failure to yield, and then pedestrians were faulted in 34% of them. The most common pedestrian citation was improper crossing and darting into traffic. Then there were some that they just couldn't determine the fault. I've actually talked to a police officer many times. They arrive at one of these incidents, and it's he said, she said. They depend a lot on witnesses, and they sometimes have trouble finding a neutral, what they call a neutral witness. As I mentioned earlier, a high percentage of injuries, 359, and then 110 of those were incapacitating injuries. And the severity of the injury is related to speed. I found this illustration that it shows that a pedestrian hit at 40 miles per hour, unfortunately, has an 85% chance of being a fatality. Now, you lower the speed limit by 10 miles per hour to 30, and you have a 55% chance of surviving, and then even a small 5% chance of being uninjured. Then you lower that 10 more miles per hour, and you actually have a pretty good chance of surviving, 95% survival rate, and then a 30% chance of not even sustaining an injury. So that is part of the reason why we have the school zone speeds so low, because you do stand a much better chance if it does happen at a lower speed.
Dave, you mentioned speed limit a second ago. I think you meant the speed the vehicle is traveling at.
Yes.
But that caused me to think that in a lot of these cases, I think you'll see as Dave continues that it's more what the road is designed to allow vehicles to travel. So speed limit will only get you so far. If you have a road that someone's able to drive 50 miles an hour down, unless you have really strict law enforcement, the vehicles are going to tend to travel the speed that they can travel.
Yeah, that is correct. And in most residential, in some residential areas, you have the long straight streets. Speed limit is 25. The cars are probably going closer to 50. And then the kid, you have children playing in the street, and it just sets things up for bad things to happen. Unfortunately, over the three-year period, there were 14 fatalities. Pedestrian crashes account for less than 1% of all the crashes, but they account for 10% of over 10% of the fatalities. And 10 of those occurred in dark conditions. And here's kind of a breakdown of what happened, the kind of where and what happened. 202 crashes happened at intersections. When I presented this at the TAC committee, somebody asked me, well, does that mean that intersections are more dangerous to cross at? And no. And I thought about that a little bit, and I said, I have to conclude that no, they're not. That is just where most crossing occurs, is at an intersection. Mid-block, there were 93 where the pedestrian was crossing mid-block, and 60 where they were walking on the roadway, and then 34 where they were hit at driveways. Many of us are late for work in the morning. We back out of the driveway, don't look properly, and there's somebody back there walking the dog. So it happens easily. This 20 miscellaneous ones, these were just oddballs, and then as you can see, it falls off. There's as you go down the list, there's a few others. I'm not taking time to review each one at this time. I did want to point out that those top three categories account for 77% of all the pedestrian crashes, the intersection, the mid-block, and the walking on the roadway. When we look at, I want to take just a moment and look at the intersections a little closer. Once again, 202 occurred at intersections. That's 45% of all of them. And the table shows the direction the vehicle was turning. 80 were turning left, 68 were going straight, and 39 were turning right. And then there were 7 reports where it actually stated right on red. And then there were a few where it wasn't stated. 78 occurred in marked crosswalks. And a few of the reports mentioned the pedestrian signals, but most of the time it was kind of hard to determine what the pedestrian signals were doing at the time. Here's pedestrian crashes by time of day. I just want to point out there's a morning peak from 7 to 8 a.m. and then an afternoon peak from 3 to 4 p.m. I thought it would be interesting to compare that with bicycles. So I took the bicycle information that I already had and laid it next to the pedestrian information for time of day. And you can see the peaks are very similar. But one thing I'd like to point out is the bicycle crashes really fall off when you get into the night. And with the pedestrian crashes, you had a couple interesting peaks here. You had one at 12 to 1 from 12 to 1, and then you had another one from 2 to 3. And you probably all know what happens at 2 o'clock, but that does not necessarily mean that a pedestrian was might have been drinking. It could be either the pedestrian or the driver.
Yeah.
Here's what happened by month here. I thought this was interesting. I expected the summer months to be high, and actually just the opposite happened. The fall and spring months were high. The peak was here in October. And I have no definite conclusion. Someone said maybe that's when some of those are you have Halloween in October. It could be you have shorter days. I couldn't quite conclude why that was. Once again, compared to bicycle crashes by month, as you can see, this is very interesting what we discovered. The pedestrian crashes go down in the summer, but the bike crashes are kind of just an inverse. They tend to peak in the summer. I think the school year plays into this, but once again, no definite conclusions why that happens. And then here's age. Real quickly, we'll look at ages. I broke up ages in 10-year intervals. The 11 to 20-year-old age range was by far had the most incidents. And this is one that did agree with bikes. It, the same thing was true with bikes. It was the 11 to 20-year-olds that were involved in the most incidents. Just briefly, I want to touch on some countermeasures. I think that it's important to construct and repair sidewalks and pave shoulders. When you have sidewalks like this, what it does is it puts people out into the street. A new and well-maintained sidewalk is much more inviting. I'm not a big fan of the paved shoulders for pedestrians, but it's better than nothing, and sometimes in rural areas it's very practical, and it can also serve a dual purpose as a safety for highway safety in general. If cars would happen to go over the white line, they have something to recover with. Marked crosswalks and enhancements. Here's one. I put this picture in because this is called an offset island. What happens when people cross this, they have to turn, and when they turn, they face the traffic that is coming towards them. Here's a couple examples of crosswalks locally. Raised pedestrian crossings have the value of of making the crosswalk very visible and also slows traffic down. Unfortunately, a lot of maintenance people and snowplow drivers don't like these. Lighting is very important. If you remember, a lot of the fatalities occurred in dark conditions. And keeping walks clear. We had a lot of snow this winter. I drive to work on and home on West Market Street, a very busy street. And many times this year, I did see people actually out in the street walking because they couldn't or didn't want to the challenge of walking through the snow on the sidewalks. And education. Andrea just mentioned Safe Routes to School, and that's a very good program we have now to help you put together a school travel plan and then funding for improvements. AMATS does feel that pedestrian facilities are an integral part of the transportation system. We highly recommend you try to include these in your in any highway project if possible. And a couple other things we've done. We've done an extensive sidewalk survey in 2010, and then we used that along with a lot of other information to develop a regional transportation plan. And the entire plan is available on our website. The report that I just completed that you don't quite have yet because we're just finishing up some a few loose ends with it. That also will be posted on the website along with this presentation. And that concludes sidewalk safety presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to try and answer them.
Thank you very much. Great report. Moving right along, item six, resolutions. 6A, resolution 2014-04, approving amendment number 11. Victor?
Thank you. On some of our federally funded projects, there's some right-of-way activities that can be done in advance of the right-of-way phase actually being authorized. Sometimes projects are able to do that. Then we'll use some of the funds out of the right-of-way phase to do these activities. Well, just recently, Federal Highway has required that those funds for those advanced right-of-way activities be actually taken out of the PD phase for these projects. So in order to accommodate this new requirement, simply what this is doing is taking a nominal amount of funds from right-of-way phase and putting it into the PD phase for these projects that are listed here in case they are able to use those some of the advanced right-of-way services earlier on in the project. And it's not any additional funds in the project, it's simply shifting some funds on the basis. So with that, staff recommend to
entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
The motion on the floor has been seconded. Discussion of the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Just one quick comment. 7 of these 10 projects you just approved have sidewalks as part of them, so good job.
6B, resolution 2014-05, approving amendment number 12, attachment 6B. Victor?
Thank you. Two new projects here. One is the district-wide District 4 wave product signal improvement project. This is to install radar-based vehicle detection equipment on various signals throughout Southern Portage County. Construction will be scheduled in 2015 using safety funds. And then as part of the I-76-77 Main Broadway Interchange project, this is a spinoff from that project to do the demolition. This project is scheduled in 2015 also. And then there's a number of projects there that we've revisioned into the funding schedule or limits, and I just want to point out two of them there. Cleveland Massive Road, phase one to phase two. This is an AMATS funded project. It was split up into two phases. I think there's a water line issue with part of it, so phase one will be done earlier than phase two to accommodate that water line issue. So, also with this project, with this amendment, we recommend approval.
Is there a motion? Second. Motion on the floor is consecutive. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 7, any other business to come before us? If not, it is now 2:53, and our next meeting will be May 15th at 1:30 in the same location, and we are adjourned.